This is Gita Jayanti weekend, and rather than have our normal talk, which focuses on a theme, we'll take a theme and bring in all kinds of verses and all to collaborate it. Basically, this weekend, we're just going to focus on the Bhagavad Gita. This is the anniversary weekend of the time over 5,000 years ago when Lord Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita. I'm going to speak 10 or 15 minutes, and then I'll invite Hari Kesha up here, and he'll take the baton and take it from there. Our first slide is that of the blind King Dhritarashtra sitting on his throne, and Sanjaya sitting on his feet, narrating to Dhritarashtra the situation some distance away at Kurukshetra. In the Kurukshetra battlefield, the sons of Dhritarashtra, headed by Duryodhana, have mastered a huge army which outnumbers the army mustered by the five Pandavas, who are pious, righteous devotees of Lord Krishna. Pandavas have been exiled into the forest for 13 years because of the machinations of Duryodhana, and having returned and fulfilled all the conditions of their exile from the forest, Duryodhana refuses to give back to them as much land as could fit on the head of a pin, thus necessitating a huge armed conflict, a world war. And soldiers have assembled in Kurukshetra, which is about a six-hour drive north of Delhi. The field is still there, and there's a great statue of Krishna driving the chariot of Arjuna, and that is placed in the exact spot where it's believed that Krishna spoke the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. The conflict is about to be engaged in. There are going to be, in the next 18 days, 6,400,000 soldiers killed. Only the five Pandavas will survive, and three Kauravas, Kritavarna, Kripacharya, and Ashwatthama, are going to be the only three to survive. So only eight survivors out of 6.5 million soldiers. This is all narrated in the great epic Mahabharata. Bharat, even to this day, is the Hindi word referring to India, after a king of ancient times named Bharat. And Maha means great. Mahabharata means the story of greater India. Even within my generation, or at least at the time I was born, India was divided into India and Pakistan, thus whittling down the size of India. Now there are separatist movements for Kashmir and for West Bengal, Bangladesh and all, threatening to make India even smaller. But if you go back 5,000 years ago, India was a worldwide empire. It had its seat in what is present-day Delhi, but kings and emperors from as far away as Europe, China, Southeast Asia, they would all acknowledge that whoever sat on the throne in Delhi was the king of the world. So that's what's at stake here. This is what the Duryodhana's ambition has been in persecuting the Pandavas to usurp their rightful position as kings of the world and to take it for himself. They're now arrayed, and clearly Duryodhana is in the wrong. This causes some apprehension to Dhritarashtra. He's anxious for his 100 sons. And the Bhagavad Gita begins with these words. Dhritarashtra asks Sanjaya, Dharma Chetra Kuru Chetra Samaveti Yatsava Mamakas Pandavas Chaiva Kima Kurvata Sanjaya. What did my sons and the sons of Pandu do being assembled on the field of Kurukshetra? Now this portends ill for Duryodhana. Kurukshetra has been for many, many thousands of years, even up to this time, which itself is 5,000 years ago, Kurukshetra has been a place of pilgrimage where saints and sages have assembled to engage in dharma, righteous activities. So just by pointedly mentioning Kurukshetra, it's a portent that things will not go well for Duryodhana and his army, which are acting adharmically against the principles of dharma. And things will go well for the five Pandavas who have always acted according to dharma and duty. As I mentioned, the Mahabharata is a huge epic. It's 10 times longer than the Iliad and the Odyssey combined. But everything culminates in this moment, this half an hour before the battle. Arjuna looks across the battlefield at his cousins, his teachers like Bhisma, Dronacharya. He asks Krishna, please draw my chariot in between these two opposing armies so that I may see with whom it is I must contend in this great attempt. As the chariot sits between the two armies and Arjuna looks over, those whom he's been trained since youthhood to worship and to offer respects. In the Vedic culture, offering respect to elders is an inviolable principle. Even if the elders don't warrant it, even if they're not worthy of respect, just because they're superior in years, one bows down, one offers respect, one never contradicts them, one never speaks back to them, one never speaks sarcastically. That's even for an unworthy elder. What to speak of someone like Bhisma and Dronacharya, who have no fault, really. They're great, great, great personalities by any standard. Arjuna finds himself unable to attack them aggressively. He says, I should be offering them pujaro arishudana. I should be offering them flowers instead of trying to kill them by shooting arrows at them. Perhaps never before in the history of the world has anyone faced such a severe moral dilemma. For Arjuna, fighting bad guys is not a dilemma. That's what he's trained to do. Kshatriya, he's a kshatriya. Kshatriya means one who applies violence judiciously. Violence is generally not good, and it shouldn't be a part of the life of average citizens. But every society needs a class of men trained up in the surgical application of violence in order to curb miscreants and wrongdoers and make life safe for honest citizenry. Example is given of a surgeon. A surgeon knows how to judiciously use violence in order to remove a tumor from the body and restore the whole organism to health. Violence is generally not good, but there are instances when applied by trained personnel can remove the cancerous elements of society so that the healthy parts can grow. That's not new for Arjuna. He's done that many times. He's fought thousands of lethal opponents and hundreds of battles. And many soldiers throughout the ages have fought under those circumstances. But what's unique here is that Arjuna is being asked to kill those with whom he has a bodily connection. And that's very difficult. Very, very difficult. It's almost impossible to stir yourself up with anger against those to whom you owe so much. Give the example, if someone puts an impersonal design on a wall somewhere and asks you to throw a dart at it, you have no problem throwing a dart into that design. If they ask you to throw a dart at a human being, a fellow member of your own species, you find it a little more difficult. Maybe if it's someone whom we have been trained to think of as an evil person, like Hitler or Osama bin Laden, we might overcome our natural aversion and go ahead and throw it. Some might even relish it. If it's someone we don't know, someone to whom we feel neutral, still the effect is not necessarily paralyzing. But if you have a picture of your aunt or your uncle or your father, your mother, someone who's very dear to you, someone who nurtured you and trained you and made you what you are, no civilized person would throw a dart even at a picture of that person. And Arjuna is being asked to throw lethal weapons at not just a picture, at the personalities themselves. So you can see from this second slide here, this powerful, powerful warrior. Krishna refers to him as Savyachin, wielder of the mighty armed, Mahabahu, Dhananjaya, winner of wealth. Arjuna is a spectacular athlete, a spectacular soldier, and he's never met defeat. But now his shoulders are slumped. He's got imagine he's almost on the point of tears. The arrows are spilling out of his quiver. He's dropped his bow to the ground. He doesn't know what to do. Darned if he does, darned if he doesn't. If he doesn't fight, the bad guys will have free reign to tyrannize this innocent citizenry. If he does fight, he doesn't know how he'll be able to live with himself, with the blood of his relatives on his hands. So he says, better I die unarmed and unresisting rather than I contend with those who are my relatives. And he says, even if I win, he says, of what use will the spoils of war be to me when I don't have anyone to enjoy them with? If you think about it, things, opulences, have no value in and of themselves. They only have value insofar as we can kind of display them or share them with our loved ones and our relatives. If all those loved ones and relatives are dead as a result of the battle, then where will Arjuna's joy be in the spoils of war? He can't see any good outcome for himself, either by fighting or by not fighting. At this point, having hit a philosophical wall, he surrenders to Krishna. He says, Krishna, as long as we're talking in a friendly way, and you're tolerating my thoughts, I'm not getting anywhere. There's no progress being made. Let's change the nature of our relationship right now. Let me present myself to you as Sishya. And let me now be quiet and listen to your take on the situation. Sishya steham sarimam tam prapanam. At the point Arjuna submits himself as a disciple to Krishna and agrees to listen to what it is that Krishna has to say as his guru, things begin to turn around. The murky waters start to separate, and there begins to be some clarity. Krishna doesn't waste time. As soon as Arjuna surrenders unto him, he gets right to the heart of Arjuna's problem. It's like a physician. Physician is pain to see a patient suffering. But as long as the patient is sitting in his office and the patient is discoursing on what the patient thinks is right and wrong and blah, 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 the physician is not going to mix it up with him on that level. Only when the patient stops talking, stops wasting both their times, and says, Doc, you've got a medical degree, you've got the training, you've got the expertise, why don't I just shut up and let you give your authoritative opinion? And when the physician gets that opening after having sitting patiently and listened to the irrelevancies of the patient, once the patient opens the door, the physician, who's generally concerned, is not going to waste any more time. He feels enough time has been wasted already. He's going to tell you, this is what's making you sick, and this is what you have to do, and get yourself on, pull your pants down, and I'll give you that shot, and here's your prescription, and get right over there and get on it. Don't waste any more time. So similarly, Krishna says, He says, your problem is you're lamenting for what is not worthy of lamentation. You're getting yourself all wound up. You're tying yourself into knots over something that's not worth it. It's not worth it. Our bodies are made of various elements, phosphorus, nitrogen, carbon. The value of these bodies, pharmaceutically speaking, is about $21. Why would anyone get themselves so stressed, so wrought by something worth $21? If you lose $21 some or other, is it going to ruin your day? It's not even going to ruin your hour. It's not even going to ruin, you're not even going to have a miss in your step. Krishna is telling Arjuna, this body is worth $21. Why are you lamenting over this? And if it's a question of the soul never dies. The body's never alive. The body is always dead, inert, unfeeling matter. The body's never alive and the soul never dies. So just tell me exactly where the cause of your lamentation is here. The soul lives for eternity. Soul gets the just results of its actions in this life. And the body never really lived. You know, we talk about a living body. There is no such thing. Living body only appears to be living because of the presence of the soul inside, which animates it. You look at a car. Car has tinted windows, and you notice the car is going forward, and sometimes it's stopping, sometimes it's backing up, sometimes going to the right, sometimes it's going to the left. So you don't make a mistake of thinking that because the car is moving, and maneuvering that the car is alive, you know automatically that the only reason the car is moving is because there is an active principle inside the car. Otherwise, we all know the car wouldn't be able to do anything without the active principle inside the car. So there is no such thing as a living body. The body is dead. It only appears to go forward, go backwards, jump up, go to the left, go to the right, speak, because of the active principle of the soul within the body. And that soul is eternal. So what is it? Where is the cause of lamentation here? Nobody really ever dies. Nahanyate hanyamane sirire. Death only refers to the body, which walks upright for some years, and then it goes back to its normal, inert state. Earth goes to earth, fire goes to fire, water goes to water, air goes to air, ether goes to ether. All the various elements go back and merge with the totality of those elements. The soul continues on in its journey, reaping the results of the actions in this present life. Krishna says, Dehi noshmin yata dehi komaram yovaram jaratata dehantara bhaptir didastata namoyate. Soul never dies. Like, for instance, you have a daughter. She's 4 years old or something like that. All right. So her body will die. The present body that she has will die. It won't die suddenly, but over the course of every 7 to 10 years, all the cells of anybody's body die and are replaced by new ones. So 7 to 10 years from now, she'll have a new body. The body that she has right now will be, for all practical purposes, dead and gone. But she'll still be there. She'll still be there in a new body, in a different body. That's happening to all of us at every moment. The body is constantly in a state of change, and yet we're always the same. Krishna says, as the soul passes in this body from boyhood to youth and into old age, similarly the soul passes to another body at the time of death. So what's happening to us right here and now is in many essential ways not any different than what's going to happen to the warriors at Kurukshetra. We might as well just have a pity party, all lay down and cry for the cells that we lost last night while we were sleeping in our bed. It would be ridiculous. It would be pointless. And it would be hardly any more meaningful if at the end of 7 years we say, well, that's ridiculous. You know, I mean, the cells that I lost last night are just 1/1,000,000th of the totality of cells in my body. I'm not going to get all bent out of shape over the cells I lost last night. However, every 7 years, I'm going to have a pity party. Every 7 years, I'm going to invite my friends over, and we're going to have a wake for all the cells that have died and been replaced over the last 7 years. That would hardly be more meaningful. That would be almost as ridiculous. The fact is that nothing ever dies. And the fact that these soldiers are going to get cut down, and it's only going to take half an hour, 10 minutes, or 15 minutes when they finally meet their nemesis, when they finally meet that opponent who bests them and kills them, quote unquote, is really not a lot different than what's happening to us at each and every moment. The soul is going to leave the body. Granted, it's not a gradual departure. It's an abrupt departure. But it is a departure. The soul will leave the present body of Duryodhana, of Bhishma, of Karna, of all the various warriors, and the soul will adopt another body. But that's happening pretty much constantly at all times and all places and all circumstances. So Krishna says there's really nothing extraordinary here. It only becomes difficult to the degree that we're in bodily consciousness, that we're attached to the body. And I'll just comment on this one slide here and then invite Harikesha to come up and take it away from there. This is a film strip, and it shows a person in various stages of running. Now, when you go to the movies, you might see someone running, and it looks continuous. It looks seamless. What it actually is that there are many still photographs. There are many negatives, and each one is just a still photograph, and each one is just slightly different from the previous one. One photograph has the runner like this and one like this. The naked eye can hardly even see the difference between one photograph and another. There are indiscernible differences. That's what I'm talking about. Our body changes. The body we have today is not exactly the same body we had yesterday. Tomorrow's body will be slightly different. There are changes which are not visible to the naked eye, but they are inexorable. They're occurring constantly. And if you look at what happens in the upper part of the frame here, if you look at what happens during the short space of 80 or 90 years, it actually adds up to quite dramatic change. There's actually a lot of changes that happen. They're just not visible to the naked eye. So in the same way, when you go to a movie and you see all these negatives, all these still frames traveling at a certain velocity through being penetrated by a certain type of light, it gives you an illusion of uninterrupted seamless activity. But actually, every single frame is different from the other one. So similarly, we have the illusion that it's one person, that it's one body. And in some ways, it is one body, but the one body is actually changing constantly. So there's two ways you can look at it. You can look at it as one changing body, or you can look at it as many, many different bodies. But in any case, we're not changing. The body's changing. And that leads us to the inescapable conclusion that we're not this body. If the body is constantly in a state of change and we're always the same, then we cannot be the body. We had a discussion with a lady on the other day when we celebrated Gita Jayanti in the temple. And she was an LDS lady, so downstairs we had a discussion. And she said she got quite adamant because based on the LDS philosophy, you're changing, you're changing. She says, we're growing, we're learning, we're changing. I say, growing, learning, and changing, growing and learning doesn't necessarily mean that you're changing. It's you that are growing and you that are learning. But it's not you that are changing. We're still the same person. Here's a Bansuri, and she has a four-year-old body. If we fast forward and she's 11 or 12 years old, she has a different body, we're not going to call her by a different name. We're not going to give her a different name when she's got a different body. She's still going to be Bansuri. So she's still, obviously she's grown, she's learned things, she's changed in many ways, but she's still the same person like that. Example is given, a man puts a deposit in the bank and he signs the deposit slip for $1 million. And he just leaves it there as a long-term investment. So he comes back 20 years later, and he signs with a different hand. With a different hand, he signs the withdrawal slip, and the teller refuses to recognize it. He says, "Well, this is not the same hand that signed the deposit, so I'm not going to give you your money." That's absurd, isn't it? It may be a different hand, but it's the same person. So the fact remains, no matter how much you want to spin it, we say we're the same, the body's always changing. QED, we're not this body. So at that point, Harikesh, you want to come up here and continue on with this slide of two birds in the tree.
Did that lady become at all convinced or not?
No, not at all.
But it was all cordial. She took a lot of shots.
So now I will continue a few more slides for maybe 15 minutes. This slide represents the spiritual part of our existence. So within this body, which is all matter, there are two spirits. One is our identity, the soul, and the other is super soul. The bird which is flying and looks very active is our identity, which is we. Sitting on a tree, the tree represents this body. So on the tree, we are sitting and always active, doing this, trying to enjoy the fruits of our activities. And the other bird is just quietly sitting and watching. And that bird is a witness to all our actions. And the other bird within our body is the super soul, which is another representation of Supreme Personality, of Godhead. So he is a witness to all our activities, so he rewards us or punishes us based on the laws of karma. So that's why sometimes we get good results, sometimes we get bad results, depending on what we did, because he has witnessed all our activities. So we should never think that nobody is watching us and we can do anything. Nobody is looking at us. So even if I commit some bad thing, who cares? God is always watching us. So there is nothing we can do which can go unwatched. And this slide represents how as an individual person we associate with matter and what all things happen on the way, and at the end one gets bound by the results of one's activities. So these two verses in Bhagavad Gita, 62.62 and 2.63, says, Dhyayate vishyan punsha sangasteshu pujayate sangat sanjayate kama kamat krodho vijayate krodhat bhavati sammoha sammohat smriti vibhrama smriti vranshad buddhinasho buddhinashat pranashyati. So on the top we see the person is watching a girl. So that is dhyayate vishayan punsho. Vishayan means the object of the senses, vishay. So when one is dhyayate means meditating or thinking about the objects of the senses, then one develops attachment. Sangaste supajayate. So one develops attachment. And from attachment, lust develops. Sangat sanjayate kama. From sangha, which is attachment, lust develops, kama. Means one develops the desire to enjoy that object. It could be a lady, it could be a sport, it could be television, some movie. When we see some movie, initially we don't have too much attachment. Somebody is watching and we see that, then we develop an attachment. And then we also develop a desire to watch that movie. Similarly, here, a person is looking at a girl. So initially there is no desire to enjoy that person. But by looking at it for quite some time, one develops attachment. And then it develops desire to enjoy it. And then if the desire is not fulfilled, because in the material world, no desires are completely fulfilled. Anything we want to enjoy, but when we enjoy it, we don't feel fully satisfied. Because that's the nature of the material world. And if there is any obstruction in their enjoyment, that results into krodha. Kamat krodho vijayate. Then one becomes angry. We see below, the second from the bottom, on the left side. That is some anger, the angry mood. Kamat krodho vijayate. Then krodhat bhavati sammoha. When one is angry, one gets bewildered. Means he is not able to think what is right and what is wrong. Sammohat smriti vibhrama. On the right side is smriti. When one is bewildered, then he loses memory. He loses memory. Smriti vibhrama. Loses memory means he loses the knowledge that one has acquired. Even if one has studied and he knows this is right to do, this is wrong to do, but if one is bewildered, that knowledge goes on the back side. And one cannot use that knowledge. So that becomes smriti vibhrama. Smriti vranshad buddhinasho. And one has lost the memory and lost the knowledge, means currently that knowledge is not there to help that person, then buddhinasho. One loses the intelligence. Intelligence means the sense of right and wrong. What is good, what is bad, what to do, what not to do. That intelligence is gone. And buddhinashat pranashyati. And then one falls down. So this is how the material nature works. So if we want to stop, if we know that something is bad, stop it at the beginning. It's very easy to stop something at the first stage rather than on the third stage. If we are involved, if we see some beautiful lady and we start developing some kind of attraction, stop it. Just because at that time we still have intelligence. We can use that knowledge, we can use that intelligence, and we know that it's not right. Stop it. We see somebody is watching a movie and that movie is not for any knowledge purpose, or it's just a sense gratification. And at that time we have memory, we have knowledge, we have intelligence, we can say it's not good, let us stop it. If we think that no, it's a little bit, 1 hour, half an hour, we can watch it. We watch it, then we get involved into it, and we get attached to it, and we also develop different kind of desires. And then the more we progress, it's difficult to stop. So if you want to stop, stop it at the first stage. That's what intelligent people do. And this slide represents the Sankirtan movement, dharma of this age, the process of cleaning our heart. Lord Chaitanya, who is Lord Krishna himself, appeared 500 years ago on the holy land of Navadvip. We just visited Mayapur, and we had the opportunity to hear about the glories of Navadvip Dham. So he appeared in this auspicious land to revive our, to give us the knowledge to revive our eternal relationship with Krishna and to distribute the love of God, because this is the dharma of this age. In different ages, the process of purification is different. In Satyuga, it's the meditation. In Treta, it's the yajna. In Dwapar, it's worship, very opulent worship in the temples. But in Kaliyuga, Kalautad Harikirtanat. In the Kaliyuga is the process of chanting the holy name of Krishna. That cleanses our heart. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us 8 verses, Sakshastakam. And the first verse is Cheto Darpanam Archanam. The process to clean the heart is Sankirtan. Paramam Sankirtanam Vijayate, Krishna Sankirtanam. So he gave us this process to chant the name of God and study Srimad Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavad Gita, to clean our heart with all the material impurities. We have so many impurities within our heart. And unless we clean all those, we cannot really be happy. So the distress that we have in this material world does not come really from outside. We feel like, because of this person, I am suffering, or because of this house is not good, I am suffering. It's very cold outside, that's I am suffering. We attribute all our distress to external things or external material nature. But actual distress is because of the impurities that we have within our heart. Kaam, krodh, lobh, moh, mat, matsar. It's the lust, anger, greed, attachment, jealousy and pride. These are impurities. They are actually the actual cause of our distress within this world. So if we clean our heart from all these impurities, then we will be happy. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu told us the process of cleaning our heart. That is chanting the name of Krishna in a proper state of mind. So this slide represents the verses in 7th chapter, I think, I don't remember the exact verses, but on the top we have Krishna, and then we have some demigods who have been empowered by Krishna to take care of the material nature and provide all the necessities that are required for the maintenance. So they are acting on behalf of God. So whatever they provide us, we should be thankful to them. But at the same time, we should not think that they are acting independently. Because they are helping us, they provide, the sun provides heat, Lord Indra provides rain, Vayu, Varun Dev provides air, fire god provides fire. So we need all these things in this material world for us to live, so we should be thankful to them, but simultaneously we should understand that they are acting on behalf of Krishna and they are not independent of Krishna. So, and Krishna says that if we want to worship, then there are two ways. If we worship the demigods, which is fine, but then Krishna says that is not the ultimate worship. And in that way also you are worshipping me only, but then that is called avidhi purvakam, which is not the proper way of worshipping me. Because, so if one is intelligent, then one should directly worship Krishna. That's what he recommends in Bhagavad Gita. And he also tells the ultimate destination that one goes to by worshipping the demigods is to the demigods planet. But in demigods planet also, all the problems of material world is there. One has to take birth and one has to die. One may not have diseases, one may not have old age, but one still has the birth and death. When one's bank balance of all the pious activities is exhausted, Shine Punya Martalokam Vishanti, one has to come back to this material world. So intelligent people who do not desire for any material benefits, they worship Krishna. And he says, those who worship me, they come to my planet. And what are the characteristics? What are the what is the positive side of going to Krishna's planet? Is na tadbhashyate shuryo na shashanko na pavaka yad gattvana nivartante tad dhama paramamma. And the demigod's planet, he says, chine punya martalokam vishanti. But in the spiritual world, yad gattva na nivartante, one will not come back. Tad dhama paramamma, because that is the eternal abode of Krishna. So those who are intelligent, they should worship Krishna and they should not desire for any material benefits. Even though we should be thankful to the demigods, but simultaneously we should focus our mind and all our worship to Krishna. This slide, Prabhuji explained yesterday, represents the three modes of material nature. And though they have been compared to, on the right bottom, where there's an embryo, and the little body is there. So it's compared with the mode of ignorance. The whole material nature is comprised of three modes of material nature: mode of goodness, mode of passion, and mode of ignorance. And mode of ignorance is more grossly grossly covered by material nature, and the more we go up, it goes to more subtle covering, but still it's a covering. So in this one, in the embryo one, it's everything very dark and one cannot think too much and cannot do too much. It's just sitting there, so it's a mode of ignorance. And it's characterized by laziness, sleepy, intoxication. These are the characteristics of mode of ignorance. There is not much activity in the mode of ignorance. When one goes to mode of passion with the tiger, it's very active. It wants to do something, always running after something. Too much passion is there. And it's bound by those desires. And here one yogi is doing tapasya. That's what it is, right?
Smoke covered, fire covered by smoke.
Fire covered by smoke. So it's more shuttle covering. Fire is covered by smoke, but still it's a covering. This verse it's in second venture, it's some seventh. Like some chapter is there. So fire covered by smoke is compared to the mode of goodness. That kind of covering. So even that is a covering in the material world. So there are three coverings. We have mode of goodness, mode of passion, and mode of ignorance. It's more gross. Is covering by mode of ignorance is gross. Then subtle. It goes on subtle. But all three are the coverings. And Krishna advises us to come out of this mode of material nature. Because as long as we are covered, we have some desires. And we have to get the results of we do some activities with certain desires and we get the results. The results may be good or bad, but we are still bound. If we are acting in mode of goodness, still we have good results. And we have to come back to this material world to enjoy the results. We did a lot of charity, helping poor people, with the desire to get name and fame. We get good results. We will be born in a rich family with good, beautiful body. And then once we have all this opulence, we become arrogant. And then we again go into this cycle. Because when we become arrogant, we develop pride, and then we commit sins. We then treat less intelligent people or poor people with disgust. We don't respect them because we think I am very superior. And then we get bound by the sinful activities, we get bad reactions, and this goes on. So there are three kind of coverings we have as long as we are in this material world. this slide represents the verses in chapter 4 when Krishna is telling that this knowledge that he is giving to Arjuna is not the first time he is giving. He has given this knowledge a long, long ago to Sun God. And from there, it came Sun God Vyoshvan, then came to Manu, and then to Ikshvaku. And then it was coming down in that disciplic succession, but due course of time, the knowledge was lost. And that's why he is giving it again. Evam parampara praptam, evam rajarsharabhudhiv. So the knowledge that's why this knowledge of Bhagavad Gita is called eternal. This knowledge is eternal. It has not originated at certain, it's not like only 500 years ago this knowledge came, 5,000 years ago this knowledge was given. This knowledge has been existing eternally, because this knowledge is about our eternal relationship with God. So the knowledge is also eternal. Everything about this knowledge is eternal. We are eternal, the knowledge is eternal, God is eternal. But because the knowledge was lost in due course of time, so he is giving it again. And that's what happens with any religious organization or any, if it's not followed properly, over time it gets lost. Because if it's not transmitted completely, then over a few generations it gets diluted or it gets lost. This one is, I will cover this one and maybe one more in the interest of time. So this slide represents the incarnations of God. Krishna tells in Bhagavad Gita 4th chapter, Yada yada hi dharmasya glanir bhavati bharata abhyuttanam adharmasya latmanam shyamyaham paritranaya shadhunam vinashaya shujaskritam dharma sansthapanarthaya sambhavami yuga yuga. In every age, when there is some problem in the society due to irreligious people, he incarnates himself to protect the saintly people, paritranaya sadhunam, and to destroy the miscreants. He incarnates in every age. So from the bottom left is the first incarnation. There are many incarnations. He has unlimited incarnation. These are the prominent ones that have been described in our scriptures. It's called a Matsyavatar. He took the form of a fish to protect the Vedas. Then on the left line, we go to the second, is the Kurmavatar. He incarnated as a tortoise when the Madrachal mountain was churned by the demigods and the demons. Then some support was required. And he incarnated and he went in the sea and stayed there. And on his back, this mountain was churned. And then there were many things that came out of this churning of the ocean. So that was Kurmavatar. And then there is the third one is Varahavatar. When Hiranyaksha, he took Mother Earth and put into, he took it somewhere else. Then it says in some outside of, taking the Earth means it has to be very big. That person has to be really huge. And because Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, they were so powerful, they had conquered the three worlds. Means including Earth, Moon, demigods, planets, and all the lokas. And they were so powerful. And they had taken the Earth and hidden it somewhere else. So Lord took the incarnation of a Varahadev. And he pulled the Earth out. And put out, and then he fought with Hiranyaksha and he killed him. That is the incarnation of Varahadev. And then on the top left corner is Lord Nrisimhadev. He appeared from the pillar to protect his devotee Prahlad Maharaj. And every day we sing this Nrisimharati. The only purpose of Lord Nrisimhadev's incarnation was to save his devotee Prahlad Maharaj. That's a very special incarnation. He protects his devotees. And then on the top center, we have Lord Vamandev, who appeared as the son of Mother Aditi because Bali Maharaj, he has conquered the heavens and he has kicked demigods out of the heaven, and demigods prayed to get the heaven back, and then Lord appeared as their brother, younger brother to Lord Indra, and he went to the Yajnashala, where Bali Maharaj was performing Yajna, and he had completed 99 Yajnas, and he was doing the last one. And if he completes that one, then he will become the king of the heaven. So Lord Vamanadeva comes and he asks for the boon to get the 3 feet of land, and he takes everything. But Bali Maharaj knew that he is Supreme Personality of Godhead, so he gives him those 3 feet. And even that means he's disobeying his spiritual master Shukracharya, but he knew that the purpose of all these yajnas to get the mercy of the Absolute Truth. And if he is so kind that he has come himself, then what else I need? That's the nature of a devotee, because he is such a great devotee, and he is the grandson of Prahlad Maharaj, the Narasingadeva. So he is so fortunate that Lord incarnated in his family twice. So fortunate that Lord personally came as Lord Narasingadeva to his grandfather and to himself as Lord Vamanadeva. And then is on the right corner, we have Lord Parashuram, who came to kill the Kshatriyas, the administrative class, who were very proud and they were not following the religious principles properly. And they were torturing and too much involved in material sense gratification. So he killed all of them to establish the proper religious principles, and he donated all the lands that he got to the Brahmanas. And then below that we have Lord Ram, which everyone knows is called Maryada Purushottam, and he appeared in Treta Yuga, and he performed the full pastimes from childhood to his youth. And those pastimes are very, very, those pastimes very much serve as guiding principles for a common man. Because he, even though he was Supreme Personality, he still followed a lot of rules and regulations he had within his life to set proper examples of a family man, proper examples for a administrator, proper example as a son, wife. For every stage that we went through, he followed the proper religious principles to set the proper guidelines for everyone. So he is called Maryada Purushottam. And Krishna is called Leela Purushottam. And below that we have Lord Balaram, who appeared as the elder brother of Lord Krishna. And he was always there with Krishna as long as Krishna performed his pastimes on this planet. And then below on the right corner, bottom corner, we have Lord Buddha, who appeared in Kali Yuga at the beginning, around after 2000 years. And his main purpose was to stop the violence that was caused to animals in the name of Vedic sacrifices. Because at that time, the Brahmanas, they were performing Vedic sacrifices and they were killing animals with no control. Unlimited, uncontrolled killing was going on in the name of Vedic scripture. So he denied Vedas. He said, Vedas are not true, because his main purpose was to stop that and establish the principle of non-violence. And then on the bottom center, we have Lord Kalki. This incarnation is yet to happen at the end of Kali Yuga, when people would have no good qualities and there is no way to correct them. So he will appear as Lord Kalki and he will destroy everyone. He will kill everyone. And that will be the end of Kali Yuga. And in the center we have Lord Krishna. He is called the source of all these incarnations. Krishna is not considered as one of the incarnations. Ete chams kalapunshah krishnastu bhagavan svayam. So all these are either direct incarnations or either direct expansions or expansions of the expansions. Chamsa kala, either they are ansha or they are kala. So either they are planetary expansions or portions of the planetary expansions of Krishna. But Krishna is krishnastu bhagavan svayam. He is the Swayam Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is the source of all these incarnations. We'll go one more slide. So this slide represents the qualities of a saintly person. He says, Vidya vinaya sampanne brahmane gavahastini shuni chaiva shopakecha pandita samadarshina. So this tells what is the vision a saintly person has. So on the right side we see a person holding a danda and chanting back. He is a pandita. And how does he see everyone? He sees a Brahman who is standing on the left side. And it's not only just a Brahman, he is a Vidya Vinaya Sampanne. He is such kind of a Brahman. A Brahman who is equipped with knowledge and equipped with humility. Means such a highly qualified Brahman. So, Vidya Vinaya Sampanne, Brahmane. Gau, we have a cow. Hastini is elephant. Shuni means a dog, and Shuni Che Eva Swapake. Swapake means dog eater, which we see on in the center close to elephant is a dog eater, means Chandal. So these are five different bodies, the soul living in five different bodies and is going from one extreme to another extreme. One extreme is Vidya Vinaya Sampanne Brahmane, means a Brahman who is equipped with knowledge and humility. He's a very highly qualified Brahman, is one extreme. And dog eater is another extreme. A person who has no sense of spirituality, no religious principles to follow in life. He lives a very abominable life. He's a dog eater. So this and in between we have a cow, we have a dog and elephant. So it's a different level of consciousness in these five different people, five different persons. But a pandita, he sees all these five with equal vision. That is the characteristic of a saintly person. They don't look at the external covering. They don't look at the body. Even though they know, they understand that this is an elephant, this is a dog. But they don't disrespect someone just because he has a lower level of consciousness. And they always try to help how this person can elevate his own consciousness. So they always treat everyone with respect, with equal vision. Pandita Samadarshina. So there are more slides, but in the interest of time, we will close here and hand over to Charu Prabhu.